Welcome to Making Waves, independent voices for peace and justice on WSCA 106.1 LPFM. It's March 12th, 2005. I'm Amy Antonucci and happy to introduce our show to you today. Today we continue with the theme of women's lives for Women's History Month. In the first hour of our program, we'll hear an interview with longtime advocate for women's reproductive rights here in New Hampshire, Bridget Ordway. In the second hour, Jennifer Bills, formerly of Portsmouth, tells us about her experience at the UN Women's Conference in Beijing 10 years ago. We will also hear from another woman activist, Tyler Edgar, who will tell us about her work in New Hampshire currently on behalf of the Alaska Coalition, which is working to stop efforts to drill for oil in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. There will also be lots of music, more information, anniversaries, announcements, and more. First, we go to Jeff White with some news.
Good afternoon. This is Jeff White with news from Making Waves. This first story from Reuters. The Bush administration's secret program to transfer suspected terrorists to foreign countries for interrogation has been carried out by the Central Intelligence Agency under broad authority that has allowed it to act without case-by-case approval from the White House or the State or Justice Departments, according to current and former government officials. The unusually expansive authority for the CIA to operate independently was provided by the White House under a still-classified directive signed by President Bush within days of September 11th. The process, known as rendition, has been central in the government's efforts to disrupt terrorism, but has been bitterly criticized by human rights groups on the grounds that the practice has violated the Bush administration's public pledge to provide safeguards against torture. In recent weeks, several former detainees have described being subjected to coercive interrogation techniques and brutal treatment during the months spent in detention under these programs. In public, the Bush administration has refused to confirm that the rendition program even exists, saying only in response to questions about it that the United States does not hand over our people to face torture. The CIA has flown 100 to 150 suspected terrorists from one foreign country to another, including to Egypt, Syria, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, and Pakistan. Each of those countries has been identified by the State Department as habitually using torture in its prisons, but the official said that guidelines enforced within the CIA require that no transfer take place before the receiving country provides assurances that the prisoner be treated humanely. In a related story from the Washington Post, top military intelligence officials at the Abu Ghraib prison came to an agreement with the CIA to hide certain detainees at the facility without officially registering them, according to documents obtained by the Washington Post. Keeping such ghost detainees is a violation of international law. Army Lieutenant Colonel Stephen L. Jordan, who was second in command of the intelligence gathering effort at Abu Ghraib while the abuse was occurring, told military investigators that, quote, other government agencies and a selective elite task force routinely brought in detainees for a short period of time, and that the detainees were held without an internment number and their names were kept off the books. Guards who worked at the prison have said that the ghost detainees were regularly locked in isolation cells and kept secret from the international human rights organizations. In another related story, a military review concluding that blame for wartime prisoner abuse lay mostly with low and middle-level soldiers has failed to quiet critics who say Defense Secretary Donald H. Rumsfeld and other senior leaders should be held to account. Democrats on Thursday lambasted a Pentagon investigator about the abuses at Abu Ghraib and other U.S. military prisons, which found that no Pentagon policy was responsible for abusive treatment of prisoners. There's a big problem, one senator said Thursday, when investigators are, quote, in the chain of command of the officials whose policies and actions they are investigating. Senator Carl Levin was quoted as saying, I can only conclude that the Defense Department is not able to assess accountability at senior levels. The human rights group Amnesty International USA criticized the investigation as being too easy on top officials. The report put out by the investigation is at least the sixth senior-level assessment of issues related to the prison abuse scandal at Abu Ghraib and elsewhere, but also failed to put rest a political debate over the White House's decision not to afford Geneva Convention protections to some enemy fighters, including the Taliban army that fought in Afghanistan. Senator John McCain, who was prisoner of war in Vietnam, questioned the wisdom of deciding that certain categories of enemy fighters should be ineligible for the Geneva Convention protections. Quote, I worry, Admiral, very much that if we decide that a certain country's military personnel are not eligible for treatment under a convention that we signed, then wouldn't it be logical to expect that they would declare, as the North Vietnamese did, that American prisoners are not eligible for protection under the Geneva Conventions? This from Reuters. The Senate defeated dueling proposals Monday to raise the $5.15 an hour minimum wage, one that was backed by organized labor and the other assaulted with pro-business provisions. Both plans fell short of the 60 votes needed to advance and signaled that prospects for raising the federal wage floor, unchanged since 1996, are remote during the current two-year Congress. Senator Edward Kennedy was quoted as saying, I believe that anyone who works 40 hours a week, 52 weeks a year, should not live in poverty in the richest country in the world, arguing that the Democratic proposal to increase the minimum wage by $2.10 over the next 26 months was very reasonable. Kennedy accused Republicans of advancing a deeper poverty agenda for the poor by including several provisions to cut long-standing wage and overtime protection for millions of Americans. Democrats sought minimum wage increases in three steps of 70 cents each to $7.25. Republicans countered with raises in two steps of 55 cents apiece to $6.25, as well as several pro-business provisions. Senator John Sununu, Republican of New Hampshire, stated, quote, when you raise the minimum wage, you are pricing some workers out of the market. It is an economic fact. Tom Harkin, Democrat of Iowa, countered, this is a values issue. This is at the heart of what kind of country we want. While Democrats sought only an increase in the minimum wage with their proposal, Republicans expanded this to include business regulatory relief as well as tax breaks totaling $4.2 billion. In a related story from Reuters, the Senate passed new bankruptcy legislation this week. Banks, credit card issuers, and retailers have pushed for 8 years for bankruptcy revisions that would force more people to repay at least part of their debt. Such a bill nearly passed in 2002, failing when the Senate accepted but the House Republicans rejected a Democratic amendment barring protesters from using bankruptcy to avoid paying court fines for blocking abortion clinics. Senator Edward Kennedy was quoted as saying, the bankruptcy courts are filled with cases of hardworking single mothers who were pushed over the financial brink because they failed to get the child support they deserve. Yet this bill would only tighten the screws, looking to freeze out a few more dollars for the credit card companies. Critics say that that's unfair because many people who file for bankruptcy have lost their jobs or are going to lose them. Opponents of the legislation have a litany of stories. Senator Kennedy speaks of Zaria Marrero, a single mother with three children from Woodbridge, Virginia, the eldest of whom has spina bifida. Having had to return $60,000 in state disability benefits and medical coverage for the child and paying medical expenses, Marrero recently filed for bankruptcy. A recent Harvard University study found that costly illnesses led to about half of all personal bankruptcies. 18 Democrats and the Senate's lone independent joined Republicans in approving the legislation. That would mark a second victory for Bush this year on pro-business legislation he has sought. I applaud the strong bipartisan support in the Senate to curb abuses of the bankruptcy system, the president said in the statement. Reforming the system with this common sense approach, more Americans, especially lower income Americans, will have greater access to credit. I guess so they can get into further debt. Not unlike the government. Democratic opponents argued that the changes would keep people who are overwhelmed by medical costs or loss of job hopelessly in debt for the rest of their lives. Senator Patrick Leahy, Democrat of Vermont, said the concerns and interests of consumers, poor and middle-class families, our uniformed service members and their families, and veterans were cast carelessly aside. Over the past 2 weeks, Republicans knocked down Democratic attempts to ease the impact of the legislation on people facing huge debts they cannot pay, including single parents, the unemployed, the ill, and people serving in the National Guard, many of whom have lost their jobs and cannot afford their mortgages. And this story from News World Communications Friendly fire incidents by the U.S. military against coalition members trying to blend in with the local Iraqi population have increased dramatically over the past few months, according to security sources in Baghdad. The incident in which U.S. troops opened fire on a vehicle carrying a just-released Italian journalist who was hostage for a month was just the latest in a series of fatal mistakes. In one incident in December, two vehicle convoys were fired upon by the U.S. military forces at checkpoints as they headed toward Baghdad International Airport. On the way back, they were fired on again. Security companies, frequently the target of terrorist attacks, now regularly travel heavily armed with their clients in beat-up cars or armor-fitted sedans so as not to attract attention. Some security experts say that the number of incidents which have left both dead and wounded could be due to the recent changeover of troops. Some of the forces scheduled to leave are so eager to go home that they fire on anything seen as a potential threat. Some of those arriving are still nervous and still green, and also shoot at any vehicle or person seen as a possible threat. And this from Reuters. The Defense Department hasn't yet developed a plan to reimburse soldiers for equipment they've bought to fight in Iraq and Afghanistan, despite requirements in a law passed last year, a senator says. In a letter sent Wednesday, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld, Senator Christopher Dodd, asked details on the Pentagon's progress setting up the reimbursement program and questioned why it was not yet in place. Very simply, this is either negligence on their part because they were not happy with this when it was passed, or it's incompetence. It's pretty outrageous when you have all their rhetoric about how much we care about our people in uniform. Soldiers serving in Iraq and their families have reported buying everything from higher-quality protective gear to armor for their Humvees, medical supplies, and even global positioning systems.
This is Amy Antonucci with Making Waves. I'd like to welcome to the studio today Bridget Ordway to talk with us about women's reproductive rights. Bridget has worked at the Feminist Health Center Portsmouth in Greenland for 19 years and is also a board member of NARAL, Pro-Choice New Hampshire, and the New Hampshire Fund for Choice. Thanks for coming in, Bridget.
Thanks for having me.
It's great
me,
to
Amy.
Have you here.
Thanks.
So can we start out by you telling us a little bit about the three organizations that you are involved with?
All right, I can do that.
Folks who haven't heard about them.
I will start out with NARAL Pro-Choice New Hampshire. Is sort of the political arm of the pro-choice movement in New Hampshire, or one of the political arms. And our goal is to elect pro-choice officials to office in New Hampshire. We work on New Hampshire races only, not on federal races. And also in outside of the election season, to work on legislation, both harmful legislation to women to try to defeat it, and then proactive legislation to try to pass it. And that's what NARAL does. And then the New Hampshire Fund for Choice is a fund for women who are seeking abortions, low-income women who can't pay for abortions. And this is a fund that is run by all-volunteer women who raise the money and then lend it or grant it out throughout the year to women who need it. And then the Feminist Health Center of Portsmouth, which is located in Greenland now, which can be confusing, but we are on Portsmouth Ave, so we can still keep our name. The history of the health center, it's a long one. This is our 25th year. We're celebrating our 25th anniversary this year, which we're very proud of.
Congratulations.
Thank you so much. And we began in 1980 in Portsmouth. We were a satellite of the Concord Feminist Health Center, which opened its doors in 1974. Mm-hmm. And after they'd been in business for a while, realized that about a third of the clients were coming from the seacoast, and did a study to find out that Portsmouth was probably the best place to have a satellite office for the health center. And so that was 1980. Now, when the health center opened in Concord in 1974, it was just after the Roe versus Wade decision, and the anti-choice forces had not yet coalesced, and so they bought their building with no problem. They didn't have any problems opening up. Nobody picketed them. But by the time we opened in 1980 in Portsmouth, the opposition had really coalesced and had formed pretty active groups. And so when we opened, we were immediately picketed by a large group of 30 to 40 anti-abortion picketers. And that was hard.
And where did you open? Where was the office?
We were in downtown Portsmouth, right on the corner of Court Street and Pleasant Street, in what is now a pumpkin-colored building. I don't know what's in there now, but and we were there for 7 years. And we had to endure those picketers every Wednesday and every Thursday night and every Monday night when we were open. And people had to sort of fight their way in through the protesters to get in the building. And that was very hard. And in fact, that's how I came to the health center as an escort, because I saw the need for help for women to get in through the protesters on a difficult day. And so I became a volunteer escort. Volunteer escorts helped women in and their partners or their friends in through the picketers into the building without any violence happening, which was really, it was a very violent situation. The picketers weren't actually hitting people or touching people, but they were using very violent language, which would incite violence, and that was, I think, really the idea. And so we acted as peacekeepers, and we smiled a lot, and we sort of got people in the door and smiled and sort of kept the peace outside, and that was a pretty hard job to do. And after doing it for a couple of years, I was asked if I'd like to come on staff, and so I joined the staff in 1986.
I actually know quite a few people who used to be escorts at the Portsmouth office.
Then we have a lot of friends in common.
Was there training for that?
There was a training, a nonviolence training, which was quite funny for me, because I grew up as a pacifist, and all of my friends, when they heard that I was going to take this nonviolence training, thought it was very funny, that maybe I could teach it. And I thought, no, if there's one group of people who might incite me to violence, it might be this one. And the training was very helpful. And it just, it taught us to sort of keep peace and to not take things personally and to smile. And really, the idea was not to engage, which for me is very difficult. Mm. And sometimes I did engage. It didn't do me much good. But
And you were in Portsmouth again for 6 years?
For 7 years. We were there, and the Strawberry Bank owned the building that we were in, and they were wonderful to us. The people on the board, unfortunately, were picketed at home because they rented to us, and they stood fast, and they continued to rent to us. But after some time, I think they needed to make a little more money on the building and wanted to rent to someone other than a nonprofit. So we were asked to find a home, which we looked for some time, and finally found the building in Greenland that we're in now on Portsmouth Avenue. And it's right between the town hall and the town cemetery, and the town ballpark is behind us. So we are completely surrounded by town property, which keeps unwanted visitors away from our door and our property. We are still picketed on a very small basis by a few people. There are a few people who come out with signs, but they can't have any direct contact with our clients or staff. They have to be out by the road, and so they don't have much of an effect anymore. When we first moved into Greenland, we gained a lot. We gained privacy. We gained a parking lot. We gained distance from our opposition, even though they were still there. But we lost the sense of community, I think, that we got from being downtown and having people see that we were there and have the support of the community. In 1994, it was in December of 1994 when John Salvey went to Boston and killed the two receptionists in the two clinics. Well, he was from Hampton, and he had picketed the health center at times before, and apparently his plan was to have gone to our health center that day. And for some reason, he chose to go to Boston instead. And as you may understand, staff in all clinics in the Northeast and probably around the country were very, very afraid and worried about going to work. And I was not working at the health center at that point. I had taken a brief time away, and called to see how everybody was doing, and they were okay. And then I got a call a couple of days later saying, could you come back for one day? Because we have people who are still afraid to come to work. And I said I'd come back for one day, and that was 10 years ago.
Long one day.
So that was a long one day, and I'm happy to have stayed. But since that time, we have had police officers who check our clients in, which seems sometimes like an odd way to deliver health care, but it is necessary. And it's also about $40,000 a year out of our nonprofit budget. So, you know, we run with a little less staff than we used to, but we haven't had to raise our fees The community has been incredibly helpful when we've needed them and has stepped forward and donated so that we didn't have to raise our fees to help pay for the security. And we have a very good relationship with the police in town. They've been just very professional and wonderful to our clients. So we're very happy about that. But it's an odd way to go into it. We do warn our clients. And so they know, most of them, that they're going to be greeted by a police officer, and most of them understand why and actually are quite relieved to hear that. But we do have a walk-in clinic on Wednesday nights for STD and HIV testing. And so we sometimes have members of the community who just sort of stop by and have no idea why they're being greeted by a police officer. They're just coming for a little blood test. So we do a lot of education, too, on Wednesday nights as well.
Could you tell me a little more about what is offered by the
Absolutely.
Health Center?
We provide well women gynecological care for women. Well, let's see, I think our youngest clients have been about 12 and oldest up into their 80s. It's not just reproductive care. We see women into menopause as well. And we provide abortions, surgical and medical. And we provide STD and HIV testing for both men and women. And we are a state public health site for that, so we are able to provide that on a sliding scale, that those services, STD and HIV, and which we're happy to do. So we'd like to let people know that any Wednesday night between 5 and 6:30, they can stop by, regardless of their ability to pay, and we'd be happy to see them. We do a lot of health education, and that's part of who we are as the Feminist Health Center. And often people ask us, why the Feminist Health Center? If only you change your name to the Community Health Center or the Women's Health Center, perhaps you get more support, more business, etc. That it's the F word that turns people off. And we have talked about this over the years many times as a staff, and should we change our name to maybe become more accepted in the community? And each time we decide no, that what we mean by providing feminist health care is providing a lot of information in a caring and non-judgmental environment so that people can make their own health decisions. For so many years, women particularly were sort of patted on the head by doctors and told, oh, don't worry about down there, dear, we'll take care of it. And women didn't know when they were fertile and when they weren't, and were not able to take control of their own reproductive lives. So this was all part of that movement of giving lots of information, the self-help movement, health movement, which allows people to make their own health decisions, just giving them a lot of information. And so that's what we mean by feminist health care.
Right, so there is a difference. It's not simply a women's clinic.
That's right.
It really, there is that political and empowerment aspect to it.
It's always been there. And for the first many years of our existence, I think 15 years of our existence, we were a modified collective. We had no bosses. We were all paid on the same equal level, regardless of our educational background or experience or degrees, etc. And that worked well for quite some time. We had to come to consensus. But when we became property owners and we really had to start paying taxes and the mortgage, and it was harder to keep nurses at a flat rate that you were paying everybody else, we really had to mourn the death of our collective after 15 years. And we hired an executive director, and it's been wonderful. We do have a hierarchical system now, but it's a very inclusive system, and we're going strong. And I'm very happy with the way that we've been able to provide these services for 25 years and stay in business, even though we've had all that opposition. And you know, we've had some violence thrown at us. The last incident was in August of 1999 when we were set on fire. And luckily, we are right next to the fire station. Although we were an old wooden old farmhouse and would have gone up very quickly, the fire station is next door, and so they were able to save the building, and there was some damage, but we were able to save the building and all of our records and open up within a couple of days. And we got an amazing amount of support from around the country because this made cable news. And so we got checks from people from all over the country, and in fact made quite a bit of money on that. So I thought, thank you.
Unintended consequence.
It was an unintended consequence. But, you know, in adversity, that's what happens, is that the more adversity is thrown at us, the stronger we sort of dig our heels in and decide that we're going to continue doing what we're doing. And it has never worked to try to scare us or to try to intimidate us. And, you know, pretty much they've stopped trying, at least for the past several years. I was picketed, my home was picketed by a couple of picketers, and that was the last time they picketed anybody's house. That was almost 10 years ago. I won.
Did they do that on a regular basis or
one time? It was just a one time at my house. But they didn't know that I live where I grew up, surrounded by my family and people who babysat me when I was two. And so they did not get a friendly reception from the community. And they were, you know, they were ridiculed, and they were really uncomfortable in the situation, and I think were very happy to leave. And that was the last time that anyone's home was picketed. And I think that's, you know, I live out in the middle of the country, and there wasn't anything to get out of it. I mean, they still picket events, public things, and of course, that's their right to do. You know, this, we have free speech in this country, and I'm all for that. Being picketed at home was a little different, but they still had the right to be there. They also found that they weren't very comfortable there, and so haven't come back.
I know that, particularly with NARAL, you have been involved in the political workings in New Hampshire around legislation that's come up around choice issues.
Yes.
Could you speak some to that?
I can. In fact, I'd like to talk about a bill that's in front of the Senate right now and has not yet come out of committee. This is a wonderful bill. It's Senate Bill 30, and this is about emergency contraception, which some people think of or talk about as the morning after pill. And this would allow pharmacies to dispense the emergency contraception to women without a doctor's prescription. They would still have to talk to a pharmacist because some health considerations have to be taken into account. So it's not like they can go pick it up off the counter and just walk over and buy it. They have to have a conversation with the pharmacist as well. But it would allow them to get this at any point without having to wait for a doctor's prescription. We know that this medication works best to prevent pregnancy in the first 12 hours after intercourse. And so it's not usual that you can get to your doctor and get a prescription and get to the drugstore and everything all within 12 hours. You do have up to 5 days with this drug, but it is most effective the earlier you take it. And so this would be a great leap for women in this state if this were passed. Now, this was passed last year in the House and Senate and was vetoed by then-Governor Benson. It's now back, and it is now in the Senate. I would encourage anyone listening who supports this bill to call your state senator and ask them please to support Senate Bill 30. Phone calls in this state to legislators are very effective, and it's called citizen lobbying. And because we have, in particularly in the House, such a large legislature, they don't have that many people that they're responsible for. And so when they get 10 phone calls on an issue, it's big. It's a movement. And so it really, it works better in this state than in many others to call your legislator and talk to them about how you feel they ought to vote on any particular issue. And I would encourage everyone to do that.
Great. And I understand that a bill that was not so good for women was just defeated.
Yes, and I can't remember the number of that bill, but it was defeated in the House 2 days ago by over 100 vote margin. This was a bill that called itself informed consent, but it was really a bill to restrict abortion for women, and it required clinics or doctors to tell women that they would have breast cancer if they had an abortion, and it required a 24-hour waiting period after counseling, implying that women couldn't make up their minds. It was a really hideous bill, and I'm glad that it was defeated soundly in the House. And so at least for this session, we don't have to worry about that bill anymore.
I wonder if you could give us some real information about that breast cancer claim. I have heard that before and have heard people ask about it. I wonder if you could clarify the reality of that.
I'm not an expert, but I can tell you what I know about it, which was many years ago, I think close to 15 years ago, a very small study was done with under 100 women. And this was all a self-report study. So they were talking to women who had breast cancer and women who didn't. And the women who had breast cancer, who had had breast cancer in the past, more of them said that they'd had abortions. but there was nothing really scientific done about this study, and it was very small. Now, Denmark, which is the only country to have a national abortion registry, which has been in effect for 40 years, has been able to study this for 40 years. And a huge study came out of Sweden saying that there was no connection between abortion and breast cancer. Now, we do know that a woman who does not have a full-term pregnancy in her life has a slightly higher risk of breast cancer than a woman who does. But that doesn't, that there's no correlation with abortion. Women who have abortions, many of them still go on to have full-term pregnancies or have already had full-term pregnancies prior to their abortions. So that's what I know about the breast cancer study. One in eight women, at this point, those are the numbers, one in eight of us will have breast cancer. And so what are the reasons? There are going to be so many.
But that's not one.
I don't think that's one of them. They haven't been able to prove that it is.
Another really hot-button issue has been the so-called partial birth abortion, mm-hmm. which I know there's a ton of misinformation out there about. Much of it put out there by our elected representatives. I wonder if you could give us some clarifying information around that as well.
I think I can. First of all, there is no such medical term as partial birth abortion. That is a completely political term. There is no procedure called partial birth abortion. But the controversy around this in this country has been around legislation, both on state levels and federal levels, that would ban this partial birth abortion. The problem with the legislation and why it gets found unconstitutional every time is that it never talks about a specific procedure. It is so vague. It just sort of, it talks about, you know, partial birth, but it never speaks about a specific procedure. And so this law taken broadly could mean that we couldn't do first trimester abortions at the Feminist Health Center under the circumstances that we already do. The other part of the law, because it was found unconstitutional, although it was passed at the federal level, it was found unconstitutional by the Supreme Court, partly because it's too vague on that issue, and also partly because it does not have exception for the health of a woman, so that this procedure could be done to save the woman's health. And so it has been found so far to be unconstitutional. What's interesting about this, these laws, this law on the federal level and many of them, start out on the state level. And several states will pass them, and then, you know, at the federal level, they'll look out and say, oh, look, there seems to be support out there in the world for this kind of a bill, so we'll fly it here up on the federal level. I hope that we can stop those kinds of bills from happening on the state level so that they don't get the message on the federal level that it's okay. What's happened with all of these laws that were found unconstitutional because either they were too vague or because of the no health exception for women, none of them have tried to fix those and bring them back. So I don't think this is about just one procedure. I think this is about just starting to erode the rights of abortion for women. And this is the way that it's easy for them to go at, because they talk about procedures that are horrible to hear about and listen to. And the women who have these procedures are very few and far between. And those are women generally who desperately want to be mothers. And this is the safest procedure for them to preserve their fertility so that they can try again to have a child successfully, because something has gone terribly wrong with this pregnancy. And people forget that, I think, that they get this idea that young girls are running off because they can't get into their prom dress. And, you know, you hear that a lot. And I have worked at the health center for almost 20 years, and I've talked to thousands of women about their decision to have an abortion or not, or to continue a pregnancy. And I've never, ever had a woman whose reason was because she couldn't fit into clothing or because it would be that kind of an inconvenience. This is a much more thought-out decision than those words would imply.
So women in general are thoughtful, despite what some might think.
I mean, I think we need to trust women. And I've seen the bumper sticker out there that says, if you can't trust me with a choice, how can you trust me with a child? And I just think that says it all. You know, we are moral human beings. We can make these choices. And we don't need other folks making them for us, whether they're in the legislature or in the churches or anywhere.
particularly with the so-called partial birth abortion bill, it also strikes me that it's a very convenient way to demonize women, because so many people get this picture of women doing this horrible procedure on some whim, which is so not the case.
It isn't the case. And the other thing that it implies is that doctors are out there just willing to perform this horrible procedure for, you know. And this is a procedure that what most people are talking about is dilation and extraction. But they don't ever say that in any of the bills or the laws that have been passed. Nothing is said about any specific procedure. And that's what makes these, one of the things that makes these laws and these bills so dangerous. So far, the Supreme Court has upheld our side of this, but that may not last much longer. We are really in one of the scariest points in history since Roe versus Wade. It's been 32 years since Roe versus Wade was decided, and over the years, the court has taken several cases that could have overturned Roe. And in each case, the margin has gotten narrower. You know, 6-3, 7-2, then 6-3, now 5-4. And now we have a very ill justice, and we've got a couple of quite old justices, and the possibility that this president will appoint more than one is quite high. And it's the Senate who confirms that, and so we have to be sure that we let our senators know how we feel about those things. But I think this is a really scary time, because the Supreme Court governs law for the next 30 years, really. And it's not just about women and choice, it's civil rights, it's in the environment, it's, we could just name all kinds of things, but...
Who's president?
But I don't think we can do much about who's president right now.
Of the Supreme Court.
Right. But what we can do is keep an eye on what's happening in our states, because we have a much... On the local level, we have a more personal relationship with our legislators, and I think we can have more effect on what happens here now, which will then have an effect on the federal level. So don't give up all hope, you progressives out there. On the national level, start working very locally. Well, that's my solution.
And that is part of my final question, is around what to do, and given what a frightening time this is, and how many hurdles we're facing around women keeping control of their bodies.
Well, I think we need to lose our complacency, first of all. I mean, I think we have become complacent. We've had this legal right for 32 years. There's a whole generation of women who've grown up without ever knowing that this wasn't a right for them, and without believing that could ever be taken away. Just to realize that, your first step might be, if you're not already, to register to vote, and then to find out how candidates feel on the issues that are important to you. And if you can actually talk to a candidate and let them know how you feel about issues, I would say to join an organization like NARAL, Pro-Choice New Hampshire, because we really utilize our volunteers. Our mission is to try to engage our volunteers and get them politically active. I came to NARAL backwards, in a backwards way. I was already politically active. I had been working on campaigns since I was 11 years old. came to work on a campaign in 1984 for Dudley Dudley for Congress. And Peg Dobie was the field director, and she was also the director of NARAL New Hampshire. And she was the one who made me understand that this was something that we still had to be working on. And I realized that I had been working on the elections for the election of an anti-choice congressman for 10 years. Well, he was the best one available. And we didn't think about that being an issue, because we thought we'd already fought that fight, won it, and didn't have to worry about how anybody thought about it anymore. So that was when I really got the message that this is something that we could lose. And that's when I became involved in NARAL and went on the board back in the 80s, and now I'm back again, thinking that, gee, didn't I fight this fight? Haven't I been fighting this fight for too long already? So joining NARAL, you get some good things out of it, too, because we send out voter education pieces, and we tell you who your representatives are, what their phone numbers are, and also what their records are on the issues that we watch. There are several organizations you can join that can do that. But what we do is really get our members involved and get them involved in with the legislators.
Could you give some contact information?
I sure can.
For folks interested?
The website is www.prochoicenewhampshire.org, and the phone number is 228-1224. And I guess those are the two best ways. It's at 18 Low Street in Concord. It's a little hard to find because it's a little behind the main street, so you have to know where you're going to find the office. But we welcome volunteers in there all the time. And we are now looking for people who can help us call our members about the emergency contraception bill so that they can call their senators. So if you or anyone listening is interested in helping with that, they can call 228-1224 during the week, and I'm sure people would love to sign you up.
Last April, there was a very large and exciting demonstration for women's reproductive rights that happened in D.C. I understand that you went to that?
Yes, I was there, as well as 20 other people from the Feminist Health Center, and we joined lots of people from New Hampshire, and it was one of the more exciting things I've ever done. I'd been at a march in 1989, and that was exciting, too. This was bigger, better. There were obviously more people there. It was so exciting to be in a group of people that were like-minded and who were so energized. And I came back from that talking to gas station attendants about who they were going to vote for. And I thought, well, if I came back that excited, and even half the people who came back from the march came back that excited, then we've got a good chance of winning this election. And we did pretty well here in New Hampshire, but on the nationwide level, we did not, as we all know. But I think it really energized folks here and got us moving and working and talking to people we might not normally talk to about politics and about voting. And it was, they said, over 1 million people there, which was then the biggest march in U.S. history ever for anything. So that was gratifying. And I think it was wonderful to see so many generations. You saw little babies up to women in their 80s and men in their 80s. There were men and women there in great numbers, and it was just, it was a great sense of community.
That's great. That really shows the broad support that that there is around this issue, despite what we are often told.
Well, I think that the people who are really opposed to abortion rights are very loud about it, and those of us who are pro-choice are not particularly loud about it. That's part of it. And part of it is we're sometimes reluctant to talk about our pro-choice views because we feel maybe that we're in the minority. I think that still over 60% of the population is solidly pro-choice. And I think that, you know, people start to, there are different places where people draw their lines. And what would you say was pro-choice? I would say anybody who thinks that the decision should be made by the woman herself, regardless of how they feel about abortion itself. There are certainly plenty of people out there who are personally opposed to abortion, would never have one on their own, but don't think they have the right to tell anybody else what they ought to do in that situation. And those people are pro-choice.
Thank you so much for coming in, Bridget.
You're welcome.
Thanks for all your great work.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome.
Working hard out of my days for finer things in life. Happy life than one peaceful night. When I went out for a walk, a hand around my mouth, an intruder to the colors of my womb. Then my father, my own father, took a turn one day. my mother to the colors of my womb. Womb, 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 womb. Now the president and all his men dare try to say when I might or when I may make the decisions that they set me up for anyway. Insult my mind, my rights, the issues of my womb.
That was Colors by Sweet Honey in the Rock. We now go to an interview by Steve Diamond with Tyler Edgar.
This is Steve Diamond for Making Waves.
I'm speaking with Tyler Edgar, coordinator of the Alaska Coalition. Welcome, Tyler.
Thank you, Steve. Thanks for having me.
Could you tell us a bit about the Alaska Coalition's work and goals?
Most definitely. The Alaska Coalition is a national organization that is committed to protecting the federal and wild lands, primarily in Alaska. And that means our focus right now is on the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, which most people probably know about. But we're focusing on a small piece of the refuge. So the refuge is our focus.
And the real issue being oil being there.
Yes. We're working to protect the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge from oil drilling, and to make sure that it's not opened to corporations for development.
Now, what are the pros and cons of that?
There are a lot of cons, but basically, we are working to protect what is the last intact wilderness area in the Arctic region. The Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, the area that's in dispute is the coastal plain, and it is prime habitat for the porcupine caribou herd who calve there every year, thousands of species of migratory birds, polar bears who den there, muskox, wolves. It is a complete ecosystem. At the same time, there's very little oil underneath. So oil corporations are saying that they need to go in to drill and pull out the oil that's there for our country to lower our dependence on foreign oil. Well, we know that there is no more than 8 to 9 months' worth of oil. So we will be ruining one of our country's last great wilderness areas for a very short-term supply that we are not even going to begin to see for a bare minimum of 10 years. So that's kind of the general argument.
If Bush is telling the truth about wanting to change our economy, the power base of our economy, within that time, then we wouldn't need oil anyway, I suppose.
Exactly. The 10-year time span and the things that we can do from now until then, versus waiting for the oil that's going to come down from the refuge, are incredible. And the money that we can invest into other resources that will be much more long-term and provide us beyond the 9 months worth of oil that would come from there will do far more to not only reduce our dependence on oil, but clean up our air and make us a more efficient society.
Mm-hmm. So why the particular focus on New Hampshire? I understand the Alaska Coalition is particularly putting a push in this state.
Most definitely. This year, the Bush administration is trying to open the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge through a resolution within the budget. And as it happens, Senator Jed Gregg is the head of the budget committee this year. And so we're working here in New Hampshire because he's the head, and we're working, we were asking him to leave this piece out of the federal budget. Unfortunately, we found out a couple days ago that he did, in fact, include drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge in our federal budget. Judd Gregg did. Mm-hmm. And it was taken to a vote in front of the budget committee, in which the vote went straight along party lines, so therefore it passed, as there are more Republicans currently in that committee than there are Democrats. So it will be included in the federal budget, and it's going to the floor of the Senate next week for a vote.
just to focus on the Democrat-Republican thing, that always comes up that way. Is it really a party-line issue? I think of, you know, supposedly the Republicans are supposed to be the conservationists, right?
Oh, it's funny that you mentioned that. This really traditionally isn't a party-line issue. We have individuals on both sides breaking with their parties on this issue. I think it just so happens that those who are in the budget committee voted along party lines. But traditionally, you know, Republicans are conservationists and conservative, if you will. But for some reason, this is something that right now, at least, the Bush administration is really pushing for.
How did you, as an individual, get involved in this campaign, and why did you decide you really wanted to focus on it?
I'm in the process of spending a year working for a variety of different environmental groups through a program called Green Corps, and I consider myself lucky to have been asked to work for the Alaska Coalition here in New Hampshire. Working on Senator Gregg and working with the environmental community that is here. And so I've always known that I wanted to do environmental work, and this is one of those things that, you know, I probably would have given my back teeth to work for. It's one of those things you always hear about growing up, and it kind of it rings true with not only the environmental community, but I think a lot of people here in the United States.
What are the chances of Judge Gregg seeing the light on this issue?
He did already place it in his budget, and so that is out there now for the Senate to vote on as a whole. For us, really, I think we're blown away by what he's done. By opening the door to oil drilling in the refuge, Senator Gregg has made it apparent that he would sacrifice one of America's great wilderness places and tarnish the conservation legacy that he has worked so hard to build.
Really? So he has a pretty strong record of conservation?
Here in the state of New Hampshire, he does. He's brought in a great deal of money for the state to put aside land and worked for the Pondicherry Refuge. He's been a champion of clean air here in the state of New Hampshire, at least, and has done some wonderful things to really move this state toward a better environmental record, and yet he, in our opinion, he's completely ruining that by including this issue in the federal budget. At the same time, there's a larger issue as well of kind of the revenue that will come from this, and he's tying speculative revenues to conservation programs, which is this, you know, ridiculous ploy that shouldn't fool anyone, much less, you know, the members of the Senate as well. So it's an interesting move on his part, and a disappointing one at that.
Kind of reminds me of the tying of gambling lottery money to education for some reason. I don't know why.
Yeah, it's kind of messy, in my opinion, at least.
What is the Alaska Coalition? What are you calling on people to do to encourage Judge Gregg to change things?
Well, throughout the entire campaign, I've been here for a few months working, we've just been asking people here in the state of New Hampshire to simply pick up their phone and make a phone call to Senator Judd Gregg. And while he has placed this in the budget, that is still a very crucial step for us in terms of, you know, making your opinion known. So picking up the phone and making a call to Senator Judd Gregg's office, either in D.C. or in Concord, in Portsmouth, whatever is easiest for you, letting him know that you are extremely disappointed by the steps that he has taken and the decisions that he's made is wonderful. I actually had the privilege to go to a great presentation last night with Peter Matheson, Terry Tempest Williams, and a few other individuals who spoke to this issue and how now that it has been included in the budget, this is a time when no one should be sitting back and relaxing, and we all must be acting and being fired up. And the fight is not over just because it's in the budget. And so now is the time to make a call and to let Senator Gregg know.
What is Green Corps, and how did it come about?
That's a great question. Green Corps is a year-long program that works to train the next generation of environmental leaders, organizers, and advocates. we started in the early 1990s, and basically throughout the year you have the opportunity to work on anywhere from 3 to 5 different campaigns. And so I, you know, find myself here in Concord, New Hampshire for a few months, kind of working on the heart of this campaign with the Alaska Coalition, working to protect the refuge. I've also had the privilege of working with a group called Corporate Accountability International, where I launched a campaign against Coca-Cola for their water abuses in India. I actually got to work on the election a little bit, which was great. And then I have another campaign this summer. So yeah, there are about 25 people in every class of Green Corps, and it's a combination of training and then field work.
The name suggests the Peace Corps. Is this a government program or sponsored some other way?
It's sponsored another way. We actually receive absolutely no government or corporate money. We are member funded, and we do get some grants. But no, we are not connected with the government at all.
Where do you next expect to go as part of Green Corps?
I will be working in Montclair, New Jersey. And actually there, I will be running a Canvas office. So I believe I'm going to be working on an endangered species campaign. I'm working to raise money for that campaign to ensure that we continue, you know, working on the variety of different campaigns that we do throughout the year.
Good luck with that.
Thank you.
Do you have any highlights from last night's program you would like to share?
Oh, yes. Oh, that's a great question. Well, as I mentioned before, we had Peter Matheson and David Allen Sibley, who is a well-known ornithologist, Terry Tempest Williams, who is an award-winning author, and Shubhankar Banerjee, who is an internationally acclaimed photographer. And just, I think the best part of last night, after each of them spoke for a little bit addressing the issue of drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge and the consequences of ruining this beautiful place if that were to happen. And then talking a little bit about their personal lives, they each sat on stage and were open to questions. And each of them come from extremely different backgrounds and have extremely different stories to tell about how they got to where they are today. And one of them will make you laugh, one will make you cry, one will make you ragingly mad. But they all have come together for this extremely common cause, I guess. And I think it's very indicative of the overall campaign in that, unlike a lot of different environmental issues that myself and so many others work on, this campaign pulls people together from all walks of life. So whether or not you've been a gung-ho environmentalist for 25 years, or you are a fiscal conservative and very much a member of the traditional Republican Party that doesn't always get affiliated with issues such as this one, or if you are an avid hunter and fisher, this is an issue that draws people from all of those areas. And seeing them all on stage really just reflected the variety of different backgrounds that people come from in order to fight to preserve our wild places and our wilderness areas that are, in this day and age, so rare and carry such weight and beauty in and of themselves. And for me, that was my highlight. Plus, there were a lot of people there who got to meet some wonderful individuals, and it was a great way to kind of to encourage our activist community to keep fighting. This isn't over. We've been doing this since the early 1980s. And because Senator Gregg has included this in the budget, doesn't mean that it's over. And so it was great. It was very rejuvenating for so many people.
Have you been able to go to Alaska?
No, I haven't. Though it is on my list of things to do, I would say hopefully within the next year.
How can listeners contact you to get more involved?
There are two ways. Phone or email are probably the best, whatever is easier for you. My phone number is 224-8222, and that's here in Concord. Or you can send me an email if that's best. I know some people don't like the phone, and that's just tyler.edgar, that's my name, at gmail, and it's the letter G and then mail.com.
Or they can go to www.alaskacoalition.org, I presume.
Yes, they can go there. I don't know if you can actually find me on the website, but you can get in touch with our Washington, D.C. office through that, and they can put you in touch with me.
Thanks very much for joining us today on Making Waves, Tyler.
Oh, thank you very much for having me, Steve. This is wonderful.
The body is the temple of the spirit. The body is the window to the soul. If you listen lowly, you will hear her whispering the truths that must be told. Lava flow, raging river, wind-blown trees, moonlit nights, ocean tides, desert canyons, mountain lakes, arctic lights. The body passes life on to the young ones. The body is the cradle of desire. The goddess sends her breath across the embers, kindling the sparks into a fire. Lava flow, raging river, wind-blown trees, moonlit nights, ocean tides, desert canyons, mountain lakes, arctic lights. Come down and hear her, time will abide. Come down and touch her, time will obey. Time will have to wait. For the body is the temple of the spirit. The body is the window to the soul. If you listen lowly, you will hear her whispering the truths that must be told. Whispering the truths that make you whole. The body is the temple of the soul.